these fundamentals into your brain, you know, about predicates and your algebra, planar graphs, planar straight line graphs. So that now I can do all my favorite topics. And you will hopefully know what I'm talking about. Some fraction of you will not know what I'm talking about. Today's lecture, I'll try to start at a very high level. One administrative thing. So I'm going to try emailing the homeworks back to you tomorrow. Going paperless, see how that works out. And I'm also going to probably post a new homework next week, or tomorrow. I'll send an email announcement when that comes out. Today, we're going to eventually get to the so-called Maxwell-Cremona correspondence. And this one's a real classic. Goes back to the 1860s, I guess. Maxwell is James Clerk Maxwell, the guy we know from Maxwell's Equations. There's actually a connection here to Maxwell's Equations that we're probably not going to dig into. Cremona was an Italian mathematician, and if you hunt down the writings of Luigi Cremona, you'll find his writings on this, and he just called it Maxwell's correspondence. So somewhere in there, he made some small change to it, which I still don't know what he contributed. But nowadays, we put his name on this. Since it goes back to the 1860s, 1870s, you should think about the engineering problems of the 1860s and 1870s. And one of the major topics, we didn't use this vocabulary so much, but something we call linkages. A linkage is going to be a graph, just any graph, with vertices, and we're going to embed them in the plane for now. In theory, you can have them embedded in R3, but a linkage is for now, it's going to be just a graph drawn in a plane. But I say the word drawn, but I don't mean drawn in the sense of a drawing that we had before. Because in particular, it could be the edges cross. So you can think of it also as just a graph with vertices in the plane and edges are straight lines. So the planar straight line graphs that we've considered so far are linkages, but that's not all of them. Okay. What are some kinds of linkages that were important? You could think about struts. Where you have bars connected to each other, pushing and pulling, and already you're going to start to see this notion of a stress come in. And we talked about stresses sort of indirectly when we did Tutte's algorithm, but let's define it now. A stress, a linkage, is going to be an assignment of what are really spring constants to the edges. Sometimes call them weights. They say weights or spring constants to the edges. And a particular kind of stress is an equilibrium stress. So an equilibrium stress, the one you probably studied in your high school physics class, is one where the stresses. Now, you have to turn the stresses into vectors, but the direction is just the direction of the edge, and the magnitude is going to be the length times the weight. So the equilibrium stress is a stress such that um, I'm just going to write the net force of the edges as springs is zero. And so what does it mean for the, let's say an edge as a spring, it has a weight, so it has a spring constant, it's exerting some force, some push or pull on every vertex. At every vertex, if I sum up all the forces acting on it, they all sum up to zero. So this is exactly the kind of equilibrium stress we saw in high school physics. Seen this before? T-Rex hands, have you seen it before? All right. Good. So let me give you some other examples of linkages that are not equilibrium stresses, and they're not even planar. So who invented the steam engine? Does anyone know?
Watts.
James Watt, I think. Probably other people had the same idea around the same time, but I think we usually give James Watt credit for this. And one of the problems of a steam engine is that you've got these pistons, which looks I don't know what it looks like, but it's got some kind of, you know, cylinder here that's sitting inside a larger cylinder. And there's some kind of explosion here, and it pushes the piston. Okay. Well, if you've got these things made out of metal, you would really like it to be the case that when this thing goes up and down, it doesn't, it goes straight up and down, and so it doesn't rub against the sides. It'll wear it out, it'll create openings, explosions are less effective if the gas can get out of those sides. So James Watt considered one of his greatest inventions to be this linkage, and I don't know what it looks like, I would draw it, but some kind of linkage here. There's another aspect to this. Of course, it's going up and down, but also what you really want to do is turn a wheel. You're trying to turn this motion that was like this to a motion that goes around. And they weren't really sure if this was even possible to get exactly right, and he came up with some kind of linkage here. You think of it, this is the thing that we're trying to turn. He had some kind of, I'm not sure exactly how everything was connected up, but somehow it worked so that it was almost a straight line. And he thought this was his greatest invention, better than Stevens. So this was his greatest achievement, was figuring out how to arrange these bars so that, you can think of it both ways. One is that you just push this up and down and this thing turns as it goes up. Or you can imagine, I just want to turn this and it should move this thing in a straight line. And so it doesn't need this outer sheath here to keep it going in a straight line, and the linkage does all the work. And a lot of people worked on this, and they couldn't figure out whether or not it was even possible. And the way it started to look like a classic hard problem from antiquity, maybe this was as hard as squaring the circle. You know, squaring the circle was coming up with a ruler and compass construction for pi, and somehow that was turning the straight finger, relating circles to squares. Maybe this was the same problem. It turned out that there was a solution to this. It was this guy, Poincaré, came along. And Poincaré's linkage, which I have a picture here, I can draw this one, actually solves this problem. Of turning rotational motion into straight line motion just using a linkage. So, draw some helper circles. Here, same. Rotate here, or I guess here, this point here will move on this straight line. And it's exactly right. So Watt's linkage was right up to some large number of decimal points, and over a short enough distance was really pretty close to straight, but Poselli's linkage is exactly straight. And so this is a nice classic linkage. And it caused quite a stir when it first came out. People were really excited about it. In fact, if you read the reports about the scientific meetings where this was introduced, especially into England, it seems a bit extreme. I think I have some quotes here. Lord Kelvin said it was the most beautiful thing he had ever seen. It just gives you a sense for how hard people thought about this problem was, or how much they thought about it, and that this very simple, elegant solution does the job. There's this other mathematician, important geometer, Jacob Steiner had a model of it. So when they introduced it, they brought a model, and he wouldn't stop playing with it. He wouldn't let anyone else play with it. And they said, you know, someone else's turn now, and he's quoted as saying, so I haven't had nearly enough. Right? So it was, maybe it seems kind of quaint to you, but this was serious business, because especially because I had such important use. Now, there's another way to think about rotations. In fact, in math all the time, one way to think about rotations is to think about them in the complex plane. Because, you know, multiplication by a complex number, especially a complex number of length of modulus 1, is just a rotation. So you can think about this as trying to take this linkage gives you a function of the angle here. So it's a function from the complex numbers, the complex plane to the complex plane, such that the graph of the function at this point here is going to be just a straight line. And there is another nice way that we talk about. Oh, wait.
I don't understand the picture. What moves and what?
So this guy moves in a straight line.
Yeah.
These two are fixed. These two are fixed, locked down. So I got this is all a piece of wood, and I nailed these into the wood. These guys move freely. So these guys move along these red circles. Right, and since these and all the edge lengths are fixed, these are not. In fact, these aren't even springs anymore. These are just like solid bars. We're not introducing a stress yet on this. So as everything is fixed, since this length is fixed and this length is fixed and these are the same length, these are just going to move on this circle. That's not right. I've drawn this badly. This red circle should be centered here. These are not concentric circles. Sorry about that. Yeah, that's it. Does that look better?
So isn't that bottom point going to move up when the two points go at the top of the big circle?
Right, so it doesn't work all the way. At some point, actually, it just can't go any further. It will just lock up. So it doesn't give you the full line, and you wouldn't expect it to, because I'd have to have arbitrarily long bars at some point. But over the distance, in fact, the relevant distance, if you like, it gives you a straight line. And if you think of this as a function from, say, even if you just think of it as a function from the plane to the plane, there is another function we look at, we use actually a bit in this class, at least I keep mentioning it, and that's the stereographic projection, does the same thing. So let me just draw you the stereographic projection. If I want to map points on a circle to the plane, one way I can do that is to just, for each point on the circle, I look at the line through the from the north pole down onto this line, and that's the stereographic projection. This seems like you have to solve some quadratic equations to figure out what this is, because it seems like you have to intersect a line in a circle. But in fact, there's a really short, simple way to do inversion around, and do stereographic projection, and that's so-called inversion around a circle. And so what all you really have to do is take a point on the circle. If you set this to be, if this is the origin, and you view it as a vector, you're just going to have a vector in the same direction whose length is the reciprocal of the old length. And this will map circles outside to circles inside. In the particular case of this infinite circle, it's mapped to this, when I say the infinite circle, I mean this line. If you view a line as a circle with infinite radius, it gets mapped to this circle here. And that's, so you can do stereographic projection directly by just taking this map, f of x equals x over length of x squared. So this one, this is the same, a vector in the same direction. If x is a vector, and it has length is just the reciprocal of the old length. If I divide it by its length once, it would get me down to length 1. I divide by again, and it gets the reciprocal. And so if I restrict this function to the circle, it actually gives me the stereographic project map here, and it actually gives me the inverse map as well. Does it all in one shot. So it's quite nice. And one thing you can do is if you work this out, you find that Poselli's linkage is actually, in some sense, a physical implementation of the stereographic map. And so this really, you can think of this as a new, yet another computational model for geometric computation. That's really doing physical computation by computing, say, functions of one angle into another. What functions of a complex plane to the plane. Alright, so that's all fun, and I just have to bring it up for historical reasons, and it hints that something about reciprocals, and reciprocals are kind of duality. And this map, in fact, gives a projective duality. You can turn this into a projective duality, which has all the nice, similar nice properties that we had. Instead of reflecting things across a circle, though, we looked at reflecting things across a parabola. Turns out that's very, very closely related. And if you're interested, we could talk more about that some other time. But for today, we're going to go and talk about this Maxwell-Kimono correspondence, which, unlike Poselli's linkage, although this linkage is a planar graph, unlike general stresses on linkages, Maxwell-Kimono correspondence is about stresses on planar graphs, in fact, even planar straight line graphs. All right, so we have our historical context. Let's talk about what we really want to do here. So, a lifting of a planar graph, of a planar straight line graph, is going to be a map which takes the drawing, this planar straight line graph is a drawing in the plane, it lifts the vertices straight up, so it adds a height to the xy coordinates of every point, and it keeps all the faces flat. That's all we need for a valid. So we're going to think of it as a function from the vertex that I'm going to call it h here. From the vertex set to the reals, such that every face stays flat. In a picture, what does this mean? I have a face in the plane, say a quadrilateral. If this is a face in some planar straight line graph, and I'm going to lift it up, it's only a valid lifting if this quadrilateral here actually lives in some plane. Now, once I lift three of the points, it really defines the plane, and the fourth point, now, I don't have a lot of choice. It's actually putting a certain constraint on where I can put the fourth point once I've lifted three of them. If I have a triangle, any function on a triangle will lift it to be flat. But it's very easy with a face of more than three vertices to come up with some lifting, which is not a lifting. You can have a function where if I were to move this one too high, this face is not a flat polygon up here in 3D. So that's going to be our conditions for a lifting. And the Maxwell-Cremona correspondence, which I'll just call the MCC here, is a correspondence between stresses on the planar graph. In fact, equilibrium stresses, excuse me. Equilibrium stresses and liftings. So what I mean by correspondence here is that if you have an equilibrium stress, if I tell you how to assign weights to all of the edges so that everything is in equilibrium, then I can tell you a lifting where all the faces stay flat. And vice versa. If you have a lifting where all the faces stay flat, then I can tell you a stress, which will be in equilibrium. And the way we're going to do this is going to go, we're going to put a new construction in between, which was historically called a reciprocal diagram. Okay, and we're going to get from here to here by going around about and vice versa. In this reciprocal diagram, even the word reciprocal, you'll quickly see that this is a kind of duality. So what does it take for something to be a duality? It should be that if you dualize the dual, you get back to the primal. Just like the reciprocal. If you take a reciprocal of a number, then you take the reciprocal of the reciprocal, you get back to the same number. This was an early kind of duality, and we're going to see that it really is a combinatorial duality that has some geometric content. So it'll actually tell us where to put points. This notion of reciprocal diagrams as a way to figure out stresses was historically called the method of graphical statics. Statics being like static equilibrium, and graphics being that you just draw the picture and you see that it's right. So a reciprocal diagram, definition here, will be that reciprocal diagram of a PSLG. Remember, whenever I say PSLG, I mean we actually have a drawing of it. Is a drawing, it's not really a drawing because the edges might cross, but it's an embedding of the dual graph. Such that corresponding edges are perpendicular. Okay, we've seen at least one example of this already. Does anyone name a reciprocal diagram?
What was that?
The Voronoi diagram.
Remember that?
If I have a Delaunay triangle, let's say a Delaunay triangulation, and I draw a Voronoi diagram, remember that the edges of the Voronoi diagram are subsets of the perpendicular bisectors of the dual edge. So if this is an edge, its dual is this edge, and they're going to be perpendicular. So I've drawn it all in the same color here. It's clear which is which. The Voronoi diagram really is a reciprocal diagram for the Delaunay triangulation, except for counterfeits. Okay, so how are we going to get reciprocal diagrams from equilibrium stresses? So, what does it mean for stresses to be in equilibrium? It means that the sum of all the forces is zero. So let's go back to high school physics. What do? You look at a particular object. You say, what are all the forces acting on this object? We're going to sum them up, and it's in equilibrium if they sum up to zero. So here's a vertex in a planar straight line graph. And I'm not going to call it V because I'm going to have a lot of vectors. So let's call it V. And it has some forces acting on it. Say everybody's pulling for now, although it could be pushing. And I have, let's call these force vectors, V1, V2, V3, V4, V5, static equilibrium says that the sum from I equals 1 to 5 of Vi is 0. This is equilibrium. Now, if you remember, again, from high school physics, again, how to think about summing up vectors? If I have two vectors, V1 and V2, their sum is this new vector here, V1 plus V2. You just kind of tack them on end to end. So if I have a collection of vectors here that sum to zero, if I draw them end to end, I'm going to go all the way around and then come back to zero. So what this will look like, assuming that these really are in equilibrium, I would have vector V1 here, come on to V2, V3, V4, V5. So them summing to zero is equivalent to them getting all the way back to the beginning, and so the sum of those vectors, actually, or the drawing of some of these vectors, gives me a simple closed curve. Well, it may not be simple, but in this case, since they're all pulling, it will be. And you get some polygonal chain. All right, well, that tells us that if I take a point and I just go around, say, clockwise, or I can choose an ordering, but let's say for now I'm going to go clockwise around this vertex, and I go edge to edge, that gives me a polygon. And this polygon is going to be the dual polygon to P. It's not quite right for a reciprocal diagram because of this condition. But it's not so hard either, because the dual edges, what are the dual edges going to be? Well, I'd like it to be that this edge V1 is really just dual to this edge V1. But they're not perpendicular, they're parallel. So we're going to have one thing we're going to have to do here, we're going to just rotate everything by 90 degrees. Seems to make sense for a particular vertex. You just pick one vertex and you get a polygon. It doesn't really tell you that you get a complete drawing, because all it says is point to polygon, but how do all these polygons really fit together? So let's just walk through a specific example with real numbers. So I think this works. Let's try it. So here is my planar straight line graph. And I'm going to put a stress on it. I think what I'll do is I'll say this is negative 1, negative 1, negative 1, negative 1, square root of 2, square root of 2,
32.
So let's check that this really is an equilibrium stress. There's only two really, by symmetry, there's only two kinds of vertices. One is this one in the center. And these are, this is a square here, so these are right angles. So here are, oh, I have four edges. This center vertex, it's called P. It's going, P star is just going to look like this. It's going to be a diamond. And if this is Q over here, is then Q will have a negative one edge. So if I start at zero and I start here, negative one times one this way, and this then the next force is square root of two times an edge of length square root of two over two. So this also has length one. It's not looking so good. What I should get is this. I don't think that's right. What should I put for the spring constants here? How much, if these guys are pulling, how hard do these have to push in order to get this in equilibrium? We know that if this is going to be length 1 and 1, this should be length square root of 2. This is length 2 already, though. So this is, let me give you coordinates. If this is the origin, 0, this is 0.1, 1. This is 1, negative 1. So this force is actually negative 1 times the length, which is 2. So this was 2. This one, and this way was 2. This length should be what? 2 square root of 2. So we have, and this is square root of 2. I think this is just supposed to be 2. That looks better to me. And the length here is 2 root 2. Okay. That gives us these polygons in isolation. And we want to, but the claim is that we can really glue them together. So if I label them, I call this 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. These dual edges are 6, 7, 8, 5. And these, for Q here, this should be 3, 2, and 6. And if I put these all together, well, in this, at least in this one special case, you can see it does work. I'm going to get the drawing looks like this, where the center point here got mapped to the outer face, and each of the corners got mapped to one of these triangles. And you can check that this really is the dual of this graph, because the dual should be what? It should have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 vertices, 1 square face, and 1, 2, 3, 4 triangle faces. So at least in one case, you can see that works. Let's check that it should work in general, and we'll see how do we really make this first arrow work. How do we go from any equilibrium stress to reciprocal? We know at least that when we sum up the forces, we get to zero, so we do have a polygon. Um, Right, and now these little polygons, what are the edges? Well, since the edges really are dual, when we draw it with the directions, you'll notice that from the perspective of Q, since this edge is positive, it's going to be pushing in this direction. So it has a force which looks like this from Q, but its springs work in opposite directions from opposite sides. So from the perspective of P, you get the arrow going the other way. And when you draw this, where is the dual? This edge should be somewhere down here, 8 or 6, this one. You actually get, this is P star is on the, is actually the outer face here. And Q star has it like this. So you can see that it has the same look of our half-edge data structure already. And now, if you look at any particular vertex in the dual, you need to check that these faces, when you glue them together, when I say faces, I really just mean the dual polygons, when you glue them together and you go around, they all come back together, right? That they add up very nicely and quickly. Now, a full proof of this, to do it right, you kind of need, well, the right way to do it, it was with algebraic topology. For now, I'll just give you a picture, and we'll leave it at that. So here's the picture. A dual vertex. So the red will be the dual. So if this is a dual vertex here, it's going to correspond to some simple polygon in the primal. And the edges are all, as we walk around the polygon. So here I went from vertex to polygon. I want to go from polygon to vertex. And you'll see that locally, since I'm walking around here, these are going to be some vectors. I won't draw them exactly the same. I have some collection of vectors, and the neighboring face here let's pick out one edge. If I look at a particular edge, so this is F1, F2 in our edge, and this is F1 prime, or F1 star, the dual, and say this is F2 star here, and this is going to be our dual edge, E. Then this, as I, the sum of the vectors going around sum to zero, the sum of, let's see, if I go the edge plus its twin, it's like walking this way and then this way. So this is sort of the algorithm for how you actually do the duality, and it really just comes from just drawing the force vectors. If you have the reciprocal diagram now, where is the stress in this? Well, the stress was just the forces. And if you go and apply the same process in reverse, that reciprocal diagram will get you back to the original drawing. And that's how you get at least this first part. The more interesting part by far is the one where we go from liftings to reciprocal diagrams. So we've seen a bunch of liftings already. We took the lifting view of Dohany triangulations and the lifting view of Voronoi diagrams. Now we'll see how you go from a lifting to reciprocal diagrams. So if I have a height function on the vertices, and I have a planar straight line graph, so here's our PSLG, and we have a lifting, so G is equal to, it has some vertex set, some edge set, and my lifting, H, maps V into R, I can extend H to the rest of the plane. And what I mean is I'm going to get H, call it H prime of X, is an extension of V to the rest of the plane, which is linear on the faces. And I can give you the one-dimensional version of this. Looks like this. If I have some lifting of points on a line, and the rule was that the individual, the so-called faces on 1D are just line segments, and if these have to stay flat in the lifting, then I'm just taking piecewise linear segments. It's a piecewise linear function where the pieces where it's linear are the faces. So if I take a particular point x here, this is the this will be h prime of x, where if these were two vertices u and v, and this was h of u and this is h of v, my new function for x on any other point on the line is just going to be the linear extension of that. Well, to get the 2D picture, it looks more like this. I have some, say, triangulation in the plane. I have a height function on the vertices. And now if I have a point x, I look at what triangle it's in. It's going to lift up to some point here, and this is what we're going to call h prime of x. All right. So in order to specify this piecewise linear function, h prime, all I needed was h, which was a function on the vertices. It should look pretty familiar. Now, for any given face, the gradient, let's say, since each face is a linear function, the gradient of a linear function is constant. So on every face, if I ask for the gradient of a function, I can ask about, let's say, the gradient of, this I've been calling h prime, it's the partial derivative of h prime with respect to x and the partial derivative of h prime with respect to y. Remember that the gradient is the direction you would go to increase the fastest. So it's the way you go up the slope. So in this picture, it's the gradient is a two-dimensional vector. So down here, at x, it's some direction like this. Because if I go in that direction, this function increases the fastest. Okay? Whereas over here, I have some y, the gradient of this, I would be looking at the gradient of this other face, and it would be some direction down. So once I have the gradient, and since the gradient is the gradient of a linear function is constant, and this h prime is piecewise linear, then the gradient is piecewise constant. So in any given face, the gradient is a constant. So we can define a function g, which maps the faces to two-dimensional vectors, where each face is mapped to, once we have a lifting, each face gets mapped to its gradient. So g of f is just defined to be the gradient of h prime, restricted to f. Okay. And so you can also define a function on the edges. And remember, actually, this is the goal, is to define a function on the edges, because because that's what our stress is. We're going to go from a lifting to a stress, so we want to go from this lifting to a function on the edges, and we're going to say that f of an edge, let's say if edge E is, it bounds, it's between f1, faces f1 and f2, and let's say f1 is on the right. Then f of E is just going to be equal to g of f1 minus g of f2. In this picture, if this is E, and this is f1, and this is f2, then there's a gradient on this face, there's a gradient on this one, and my function on the edge is just the difference in the two gradients. So it's going to give me a vector. So it doesn't quite give me a stress yet, but I'm going to be able to get a stress just by dividing by the length in the embedding. Well, I take it back. Actually, it's going to give us a vector, which we're just going to draw as a reciprocal diagram, and then we can use the length of it to find it for the stress. What we did in the first one.
So, the gradient of H is a vector, which is, across the X and across the Y axis.
Mm-hmm.
So what is that? GF is equal to the gradient given F, or it's except F?
This is restricted to F. So this is H prime restricted to F. So H prime is a function everywhere, but it's actually a particular constant vector when restricted to F.
Because the gradient doesn't change.
Yeah, the gradient doesn't everywhere on F. That this function has the same gradient.
Okay, and why is it like I don't get that? Like G is face in R squared. That's okay.
G? No, G is a function. From faces to the vectors. So let's draw the picture here. I guess we can go take it here. So there's some gradient vector of H prime, and this is this vector here is constant everywhere on the space. So if this space is F1, G of F1 is this vector, and we get the same vector. Any point I pick in here, it's going to say go this way. Go this way to increase the fastness. Okay, why would you do this? Well, when I draw now a vertex in my graph, and remember I'm lifting this graph, so I have some faces here. Let's call this F1, F2, F3, F4, and F5. I want to get a reciprocal diagram. So when I draw these vectors for these edges, if this is E1, E2, E3, E4, E5, when I draw these corresponding vectors, I should get back to zero. So I should actually get an equilibrium stress from this. It should add up to zero. And so why is that the case? If I take the sum, maybe I'll write them all out. The sum from I equals 1 to 5 of F of EI is equal to what? G of F1, F2, minus G of F1, plus G of F3, 3 minus g of f2 plus g of f4 minus g of f3 okay, I keep adding these up, but here's what you should notice, is that this is what we call a telescoping sum. Here, g of f2 shows positive, negative. And so, as you go all the way around, you're going to get just 0. Okay. And this another way to think about this is that I have vectors associated with each of these faces, which are the gradient vectors. And for the edges, I'm just looking at how that vector changed. I know that as it changed, if there's some amount of change here, some amount of change here, some amount of change here, some change here, some change here, but I got all the way back to the beginning, the sum of the changes, that is, these vectors here, should be 0. Okay, if I go in a circle and I come back to where I started, the sum of the changes should be 0.
So is it the case that by lifting we are trying to calculate the stress so that this sum is going to be 0?
Exactly, yeah. Now, that gives us vectors for every point. There's one other thing we have to check, which is that it satisfies this other condition about being perpendicular. That when I look at this force vector, or this associated with this edge, it should come out to be a vector which is perpendicular to the edge. This is a little bit not obvious, I think.
When you end up with 0...
I didn't add all of them. I didn't put them all in there. So I could... Right, there's actually 5 edges here, so I should be g of f5 minus g of f4. And the last one is g of f1 minus g of f5. Right, that's all of them. See now why I equal 0? Because this term cancels here, there, and there, and this over here. You've probably seen there's a similar, it's sometimes called a conservative vector field in calculus. You remember that, where if you have a vector field where some closed loops comes to 0, and you integrate the vector field along the loop, then it's the derivative of a function, and it really is, we're looking at the gradient of a piecewise linear function. Let me just transport this up here. The sum of f of the i's is equal to 0. And we'll just check that it really does have this nice orthogonality property. So here is an edge from A to B. Here's E. And there's some face here, it goes somewhere, it's F1, there's another face on the other side, it's F2. F1, there's a vector, G of F1. Let's just set A equal to 0 for now. This is G of F1. And there's some other vector, which may go somewhere else. It may not necessarily go into F2, but there's some g of F2. This is the vector F of E. And the claim is that when we take these edges as the vector, these vectors as the edges, we get a reciprocal diagram. It has to have this property that these vectors have to be orthogonal to their pupil edges. So here I've drawn it. You say, oh, well, at least I drew it. It looks nice. In this case, is it always going to be orthogonal for every lifting? The answer is yes. Here's how you check. So G... we're looking for f of e as a vector transpose a minus b. Orthogonality means that the dot product of these two vectors should be zero. If we expand f, we get that this is g of f1 transpose a minus b minus g of f2 transpose a minus b. Now, this is the grade, by definition, this is the gradient of the height function here. So let's call this the height function restricted to f1, we'll call it h1. So the gradient of h1 transpose a minus b minus gradient h2 transpose a minus b. And this, you notice that in the lifting, this edge is the intersection of the planes passing through the two faces. So along this edge, really for all points x in the edge AB, h1 of x is equal to h2 of x. And in particular, the gradient, we need dot product vector with a gradient, right? It's telling you how fast is the function growing in that direction. Now, both functions are the same along this edge, so the, in fact, the dot products are the same. So you can see this proof as maybe being a bit backwards, but really what I'm going to show here is that the dot product of h1 with a minus b has to be equal to the dot product of the gradient of h2 with a minus b, because they're in fact the same function on that point restricted to that line. Okay, so that implies that that implies what we really wanted, which was that this thing is equal to zero. So if this is equal to this, then I just move this over to the left side, and this whole sum is equal to zero. So we're kind of using the fact that these really are gradients of functions, and that the functions coincide in a proper lifting. These functions coincide on the edge; they're the same. So the one thing missing is that this tells us how to go from, in fact, all of these tell us how to go from a particular drawing to a collection of vectors. It says, for every edge in an original drawing, I'll give you a vector. It doesn't give us an exact location for where to draw it in the dual, to draw this reciprocal diagram. Which is a little bit different from the Voronoi-Delaunay situation. With Delaunay and Voronoi, if you give the, Delaunay, it says exactly where to draw the vertices in the Voronoi, because you draw the vertices exactly at the circumcenter of every triangle. Here, it just tells you, well, how long should the edges be and in what direction should they go? And since you know it's a reciprocal diagram, you already knew it has to be, you knew that up to 180 degrees, which direction they have to go. But here it's going to, you still have a lot of choice for how you actually draw the reciprocal diagram. So given a PSLG, the reciprocal diagram, before we get to the reciprocal diagram, well, we have our vectors for every edges, for every edge. A vector for each edge. So you can you have to actually choose an ordering on the vertices in order to get a drawing. So if I start with this planar straight line graph. Then I can take I can start with an arbitrary vertex And I can just do a graph search. So I can do depth first search or breadth first search. And if this is vertex 0, I start numbering the vertices. Maybe I go here. As I number, I just get some numbering in the vertices, and as long as I have a path from the first one, I know where to draw that vertex, because I'm going to draw it as the sum of the vectors I saw along that path. Now you might ask, is it going to be consistent? Is it going to be, if I had chosen a different path, will I get this, the same drawing? And the answer is yes, as long as you started with the same vertex. And you can do the same thing. So you take this, to get to, this gets you to the reciprocal diagram. You can also go from the reciprocal diagram to the lifting. In this case, then you have to do a search through the dual. And so if I have a reciprocal diagram, how do I actually get to a lifting? It's going to tell me, each of these edges tells me how the gradient should change. So if I start with a particular face to go, I start with one face and I start, if I set that face to be flat in the plane, so I just set the height function to be 0. Just like I started with one vertex to be the origin. So start with one face as a zero function. Height. So I set all the vertices to be 0 on that one face. And now, that one starts, say, in the plane. And now the neighboring face, I know for each edge, I know what the change in the gradient should be. So I know this, the gradient here was 0. I know the gradient of the adjacent face. So the next face over, when I do the lifting, I can just map these vertices onto the height function, which has that particular gradient. So this is an edge E. I had F of E was equal to the change in the gradient from here to here. The gradient was 0, and so now I know the gradient of this one. So G, call this F0, F1. F1, and this was equal to 0. And now as I walk in the dual, at each step in the search, I know what the gradient of that face should be. So the reason I call this walk in the dual is that there's some dual graph here that I'm just searching. And every time I have, I look at this path, I get the gradient of this face. And since I know where at least I have the gradient plus, I already have at least one vertex lifted, because I just came from the previous face and I'd already lifted these vertices. So I have a gradient plus a point. It's enough to specify the plane. It tells me where to map the other points. So you just walk and do some kind of depth first search in the dual, and that will be the lifting. This is a lot. I've done this as two separate lectures. Thought I would jam it all in because you guys are so quick. Yeah, question.
So we're for lifting or like a just a linkage. Is that necessarily defined? Well, defined.
So there's a one sort of problem that had lingered for a while. It seems like a toy problem, but it's related to all these linkages, was a problem called the Carpenter's Rule problem. And that one, what you do is you have a polygonal chain. So you just have a bunch of straight lines and a path, long path, and it doesn't cross itself. But the question was, could you unwrap it so it never crosses itself? And this is kind of a simple, two-dimensional question, which was related to things like protein folding. In that one, what you do is you have to build a linkage by adding extra edges, and where they cross, you just add a new vertex. And then they use the Maxwell-Cremona correspondence not to show an equilibrium stress, but to show that it was not in equilibrium, to show that there was no motion, to show how to actually move things. So he drew a non-planar graph, but then where the edges crossed, they added new vertices. And that was the that was kind of the connection.
So then you know the solution.
What's that?
You know the solution for the problem. You said it's a...
Yeah, no, now it's solved. It hung around for a while. Like it was like people worked on it for like 30 years. So there are cases where... let me just give you another picture of why this is nice. If I just drew you a graph and ask you, how should I assign spring constants to this graph so that all the forces are in equilibrium? That's kind of tricky. Like, you might locally figure one vertex out, and then locally figure out another vertex, and you might not know whether or not you'll get stuck. Like, at some point later, you might get stuck. Especially cases, let's take a nice example, like if it's a triangulation. It turns out that if you have a triangulation, though, you know it's not hard at all to find a valid lifting. Pretty much any lifting that keeps the outer face at zero will keep all the faces flat because they're all triangles. So you can find a lifting, and that lifting will give you a stress. And so even though locally trying to figure out whether or not how to assign spring constants to the edges, you might not know how to get it to be in equilibrium. Whereas if you just draw a lifting, just take any lifting that works, it gives you one. And some liftings don't always exist. You've probably seen some of these impossible drawings, like the Penrose triangle. So, seen these before? So here's a case where, if you just looked locally, it sort of looks okay. And so as a planar straight line graph, this has no non-trivial lifting. Like there's a trivial lifting, I can just set everybody to be zero, and then clearly all the faces are flat. And all the faces, if they're all zero, then all the gradients are the same, and the stress is zero. It's boring. But here, you might look, and you might start to lift things up locally, and everything looks okay in here. But since this figure really is an impossible figure, it means there's no way to lift it into 3D so that these faces stay flat. The Maxwell-Cremona correspondence says then that there's also no way to assign stresses to this, so that this thing is in equilibrium. So that, depending on how good your physical intuition is, any way you assign stress on this thing is going to start to twist. It's going to want to unwrap in the middle. Even though, like I said, locally you could start to try to assign stresses to this and it will seem to work. But globally, it doesn't. All right. So, like I said, I'm going to email you back your homework tomorrow. Got through